Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Coburn.
And did you get some rain last night? We got quite a lot of storm last night.
Yeah, it rained here in Iowa in March, and it was 70 degrees yesterday, and now it's going to get a little cooler again. But this weather's crazy.
I know. Well, it's 57 now, which is amazing for this time of year, really.
It's
true.
We don't know when you're listening to this, but we're recording it in the middle of March, which is still technically winter, but it isn't acting like it.
With most people, it's fine with them.
So. Yeah, really. So, Caroline, who's our guest today?
We have a very interesting book today, and our guest is Leah Lacks. And she has written award-winning fiction and nonfiction, as well as an immigrant opera for Houston Grand Opera, reviewed and with acclaim in the New York Times and broadcast on NPR. Her work has also appeared in Salon, Long Reads, Dame, HuffPost, and Lilith, among many others, and in anthologies by Seal Press and North Atlantic. This is an amazing story. I mean, It really is a read that, I mean, it's a page turner and everybody needs to read it.
And the title of the book is Not From Here, The Song of America. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Leah.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So this book started out as an opera. Do I have that right?
I'm telling you, I wrote that first line of the book, which is this book began with an opera, and I thought no one's going to buy this book. No way.
All right. How did you come to write an opera?
I'm still trying to figure that out. I graduated the University of Houston Creative Writing Program, and somewhere during that time, but while I was still a student, I did a photo exhibit with a local photographer who specialized in portrait photography. And we got the idea together that I would interview all her subjects. And then while they were getting really deep into their stories, that I forgot she's there, right? And while they were there at a point where they were like really happy or really moved or really something, you know, she would do her portrait magic. And this exhibit was super, I mean, the photographer was wonderful. This exhibit was super successful, like went around the world. I mean, like at that level. And that was a totally new experience for me. Anyway, then I got a local grant to start working on my memoir, which ultimately was my first book. It's called Uncovered. And I was so happy because, you know, I was living on a shoestring budget, and as writers do, and teaching little seminars and trying to get by. And I actually got money where I could stay home and write all day for, it was going to last a month. Okay, we're not talking big grant. And I wasn't into it when I get this call because I didn't know what was going on in the background. I didn't know anything about opera, but the Houston Grand Opera had a new director, who today is the director of Chicago Lyric. At that point, he was new in town and new in the country. His name is Anthony Freud. And when he got here, got this idea, he was like, whoa, Houston isn't like Kansas, right? I mean, it was like Houston is the most ethnically diverse, culturally diverse city in North America. And it surpassed New York City like 15 years ago. At that point, that news was just sort of breaking on the Houston consciousness. I mean, think about it. It's the hub of all the big oil, international oil companies. And, you know, the constant flow over our southern border, which is another subject altogether, but we can get to it. And also the big organizations that do resettlement that are authorized by the U.S. government to have offices in the refugee camps and identify, like, the most needy people to give them refugee status. They all have offices in Houston. It's like one of four cities in the country that settle people in. So the combination is like, I'm telling you, I live near downtown, and inside what we call inside the loop, everyone I meet is from somewhere else. It's like amazing. As a writer, it's like this treasure trove of stories. And I was just discovering that. But I get this, you know, one day that I'm writing away in my little cave of a studio apartment, and I got a call from Houston Grand Opera, the assistant to the director, saying, we want you to write an opera. I hadn't published.
Wait, you hadn't published anything yet?
Only the exhibit catalog for that book.
Why you?
Well, exactly. I was like, what is this? I really, really thought it was a prank call. I mean, Houston Grand Opera at that point was pretty much rated number two in the country, in particularly in new commissions. They had a major presence, and they were putting operas, modern opera that are like in the repertoire, that are being reperformed, and everyone who knows opera knows about, like Dr. Atomic and Nixon in China and, you know, things like that. I was like, what? Why would you even consider staking your reputation on me? But Anthony Freud wanted to do this about people who live in Houston. So their first thought was, that's going to be a lot of research, and it might be good to get someone who lives here. Then he went to a local literary organization called Imprint, and I taught seminars for them, and told them his idea. And the director, that's a guy named Rich Levy, he's today one of my best friends in the world, had one name for him, and he handed him the exhibit catalog to my book, because every picture is paired with a pithy or blow you away or hit you straight in the heart kind of quote from the people that I interviewed. It was a great experience. I discovered from that I love to listen to people and like pull their stories out of them. And, you know, I had learned that there's stuff you can't make up yourself. It really is a you can't make this shit up kind of.
Yeah. So,
truth is stranger than fiction.
Right. And much more, I think. And based on his recommendation, they went with it.
Wow.
I went, yeah, right? I tried to talk him out of it. I have an idea, because they gave me no shape, no demand, just vague, you know, major opera based on immigrants. Opera's used to sung play a story. I wasn't sure it was going to be that. I just said, I know what I'm going to do first. I'm going to go find people and interview them. And it's like the bear who went over the mountain. Maybe when I get to that point, I'll know what the next step is. But if I ever get to a point where I don't know the next step, I'm handing this back to you. And I got, they gave me the commission based on that.
Wow. Oh, this is like unbelievable, really. So you didn't have a background in opera. Music?
Yes. I had a musical background. Okay. It was dormant. Look, when I was 16 or 17, I fell in love with an evangelical group that had reached out to me, very vulnerable me. It's the only evangelical group in the Jewish ultra-Orthodox history, as far as I know. And I fell hard. I graduated. I was kind of a... I graduated high school at 16 and was headed off to college already. So I should have been put in a box under lock and key, but I was very innocent and idealistic, and I joined them. And I was just blown away by the headiness of their very esoteric, brilliant, very difficult ancient texts that they studied, and I wanted that. But you know, as soon as I join them, I get told, you're a woman, that means you achieve God by getting married and having kids. Had an arranged marriage, matched up at 18. I was married a month after my 19th birthday, and was covered head to foot and still starry-eyed, still starry-eyed, and had 7 children in a 10-year period, which is really no place for a lesbian, right? So, that's what my
wow.
Now, I found my out of that world by developing, because I did, out of desperation, I started writing, and then I started studying writing, and then I started reading writers and poets and voraciously, all in secret, hiding my writing under my bed, you know, all that stuff, and found my way out. So at the point that I'm get the opera commission, I'm 2 years in the world. I'm like a Rip Van Winkle or a Kami Schmidt, you know, like some person that like a stranger who wouldn't go home, you know, or an immigrant myself in my own society.
Because so you had been living in this ultra conservative protected world where you never basically had any interaction with the outside world.
Well, I had limited interaction.
Okay.
You know, but it was like I was moving through the world in a bubble. You know, I could see them and talk with them, but I didn't share my heart. I didn't connect. And I didn't have a television in my house, or it's just a thing. So at the point that I got the opera commission, I'd only been 2 years out in the world. And when I set out to meet people all over this crazy, amazing city and hear their stories, I felt like I was discovering America. And that's a big part of the story of the book also. Is, you know, shutting up and listening to people and hearing their stories, which are, I mean, the stories in this book, oh my God.
Yeah, exactly.
And little by little, I started going, wait a minute, this is a nation of immigrants. This is a national portrait. This is where I've landed. This is the truth, the truest truth of where I've landed. It wasn't just incidental, the things I was learning. And they were intrepid, and they were open-eyed about everything they'd gone through and everything they faced as new immigrants at the bottom of the economic chain when they came in. And they still loved this country, which embarrassed me. I felt like I'd met the American dream, and it spoke with an accent, you know? I felt I could follow them into America. Maybe I could learn how to live and learn where I'd landed.
Now, you also write a lot about your family history in here. You kind of intersperse stories because your family left. Well, tell us a little bit about how your family came to America.
I got to start by saying I grew up mid-continent, okay, far north Texas, Dallas, very conservative environment, public school, and with that public school education that is very selective and very white. And my grandparents lived nearby, and to me, they were settled, safe, business people, very middle class. But every now and then I'd say, well, tell me about where you were born and where you're from. And they'd say, oh, that, you know, I was second generation born in this country. I didn't know. And this exploration of people in my country made me ask those questions again. And in the course of the book, I do uncover that as well. That all 4 of my grandparents were refugees to this country. All of them went through the same deprivation, persecution, herding into ghettos, stuff that Jewish people were subjected to in Europe, and particularly Eastern Europe, for hundreds and hundreds of years. People think the Holocaust was like a one-off. It was the culmination of a long, long tradition that still is quite powerful in Eastern Europe. And I started digging to find out where they were from and how they got here. And it was... And who they left behind? Who am I? Who is my family? I mean, I didn't even know both of my grandmothers. I didn't know their maiden names. I didn't know what families they'd come from, because they migrated to New York, and then they migrated to Texas. And you know, the family kept, in every migration, the family kept splintering and splintering. I mean, I'm telling you, I found relatives in Sweden and in Scotland and in Canada. And in every place where my family stopped, there are family graves along the way.
Now, what brought your family to Texas, to Dallas?
The depression.
Mm.
Well, it was a combination of war and depression. War shapes my book so much because it shapes the migrations of people so much, right?
Mm-hmm.
For World War One, we're going way back. There were a lot of army camps and military camps all over Texas and Louisiana. So my grandmother's brother-in-law was stationed down here, and he liked it down here. I'm down here. I'm talking to you from Texas.
Right, right.
You can't hear it in my voice. And he had decamped to Texas with his wife first, and they opened a little store in Dallas. Depression hits. My grandparents lost everything. They lost their business. They had been quite well off. And at the point where they gave up, they were able to put their two girls, one of them was my 7-year-old mother, in the car, and everything they owned. They lost everything. And they drove cross country, no air conditioning, to live with the brother-in-law and sister because they offered to take them in. Otherwise, the family would have been homeless. And my mother's family, they moved into the attic in Dallas in the summer. I mean, you know, Dallas, it's 110 in the summer. It was awful. And they started over. But they did well. They were fine. They built a little immigrant business and built it from there into manufacturing. And they did okay.
It was interesting to me that in the people that you interviewed, several of them said, even if I have to go back, I will come again. I will do it again. They'll try to get in again. And so that's how, you know, that says a lot to me.
The person who said that was one of the several people that I interviewed that were undocumented. And she's anonymous in the book. Ultimately, I had to make everybody anonymous. I mean, just
oh, of
because,
course.
Right. But she was the first one that, you know, went anonymous from the beginning. Like, I never, ever spoke her name. And she was a refugee from El Salvador, a war that the United States, through our economic policies and then through our horrible, misguided, throwing money at, you know, at third world countries thing, trying to shore up a murderous regime. We basically were huge players in the complete takedown of the economy and in that vacuum of civil war. And we backed the wrong side and lost because we backed up, you know, a dictator. The country's still a mess economically. So we get a lot of people trying to get in here from El Salvador. That woman had been raped by the man who, the gang that murdered her mother. And they repeatedly threatened her over years. She had the baby. And eventually, in desperation, she left her son with her brother and came alone to Texas. I mean, for her to join a group of all men and pay a coyote to be walked in after what she's been through as a woman says everything. So
men helped her. Those men helped her. Yeah.
But they helped her, yeah. It was a poignant story.
Yeah.
And she was the one, it took her 26 days to get here, who said, if I have to do this again, I'll do it again. She was the one.
Mm-hmm.
That of desperation. After that experience, I looked up Pew reports about women who come across our border. I found that interviews showed that 70% of them still are raped somewhere along the journey. I found a really weird word that had crept into the Spanish lexicon. The word is cuerpo matica. Cuerpo is the body. Matica, obviously, is something automated. It's expressing the female body as an ATM machine. a way to get here, a way to survive. And they all try to get, if they can possibly get a hold of birth control pills, they try to get them before they set out. It's terrible. I also learned from peer reports that it's very steady. The numbers are very steady, regardless of walls and vigilantes and, you know, state patrols. We have a steady, about 1 million people coming over our southern border every year, period. Coming over, no one's ever been able to stop the flow. It didn't stop during the Trump administration. It didn't stop during the Biden administration.
So it seemed like during the pandemic, it slowed down at one point. And even wasn't there briefly an outflow? There was a time where more people were going back than were coming in for a very brief time.
So here's the deal. The people that managed to evade, there were still tens of thousands, many, many thousands that evaded. But a lot of people will come here and then apply to get in. And it was the U.S. policy for a long time to let them stay within the borders while their application was being processed. The only thing that changed, as far as I understand, I could be wrong, is that the Trump administration told all those people they couldn't stay inside the border while their applications were being processed. That was a minority of the people coming, but those were the camps that swelled on the Mexico side, and those were the numbers that they touted, that they hadn't allowed people, but they had all made legal application. So obligation to process those applications. Biden comes in and he goes, well, let's address that backflow. All he did was hire a lot more people to go down and process legal applications for entry. And the entries increased. I want to say that the other thing I uncovered was that immigration is an old and well-established governmental policy to boost our economy. And we'll never stop. If it stopped, our economy would just tank. Right now, the front page of the 2020 census, which really has a huge impact on budgeting throughout the government and throughout our corporate world, says in the summary paragraph that the population growth is flat. That's a bad news for the economy, and the only way to address it, which is just the most important thing in the world to corporate America, is to increase immigration. So it was official recommendation, interdepartmental, from one of the most influential departments from the Census Department. It's always been. We're just getting a lot of theater is what's happening, or shooting ourselves in the foot. I'm not sure which.
Pardon?
Sorry. I got off.
Oh, that's okay. I was just in Mexico last week, actually, and because my company has a production facility just north of Mexico City. And so I met a group of students in Mexico City, a group of American students who were down there visiting migrant camps in Mexico City. I didn't realize that they were that far, that the camps were that far south, but they were explaining to me that the Mexican, government had agreed to basically build these camps for people to stay while they're waiting for their applications to be processed, and that the pressure, there's a lot of pressure put on the Mexican government to do that, and the pressure, one of the main means of applying the pressure is by saying that, for example, if they don't, then we won't let avocados be imported, which are so important to the Mexican economy, the export of avocados. And of course, we'd all suffer if we weren't able to get to get our avocados.
Exactly. Yeah.
but that was one of apparently you know, one of the pressure points was things like the agricultural exports from Mexico. And also I was asking about, you know, most of the immigrants coming through now are not from Mexico. They're coming from other countries through Mexico, not, you know, some Central and South America, but even the Caribbean and other places too. They're coming through Mexico. And I said, well, how are they getting the whole way? Mexico is a big country. How are they getting that whole way? And I was told that a lot of them are riding on the top of trains.
Right.
Which is terrifying.
Right. And a lot of them die.
Yeah. So how bad must it be where they're coming from that they'd be willing to do that?
This is a matter of survival.
Yeah.
Often.
Yeah.
People are starving. So when I was writing this book, I knew that these stories I felt responsible to. I felt like I was holding them, and I couldn't hide them. You know, I felt a great push to write this book. But as I was writing it, I felt I couldn't leave myself out of it either. You know, I wanted to shut up and listen, and we all need to shut up and listen. But the truth of it is that I was a clueless American doing the listening. And I built it as scenes. I opted not to take myself out of it. Well, I went through lots of compendiums of immigrant stories, and nobody did that. Every compendium I found was just a bunch of people telling their stories one after the other. It was a flat telling. In other words, there was no commentary that added context or history or definitions, or maybe just a little bit. And so some of the hottest, most important stuff, kind of, if you don't understand it, it just passes you by. I wanted to show both how, as Americans, we can see and hear these stories and be changed by them, because this is us. This is who we are. This is who our families were. Virtually everybody in this country, their families came from somewhere else. This is a nation of immigrants. I wanted to say, this isn't the voice of minorities. I'm not some magnanimous white American being nice to give them a voice, which is a very insulting term. I'm shutting up and listening to the cleanest, freshest edge of what our country is today as a portrait. And I didn't feel legit in doing it because I couldn't find any other more established authors doing it. So I resisted for a while. And then I finally did. And then Svetlana Alexievich got the Nobel Prize and became my absolute hero. As she traveled all over newly non-uncommunist Russia, listening to people to say, well, who are we now? And who am I? And tell me. And she address those questions by listening to people tell their stories, but also by not refraining to say how it affected her heart and her view and her understanding of the world. So the book is dedicated to her.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Leah Lax, author of Not From Here, The Song of America. So how, describe the structure of the book.
It opens with a scene in which there's a preamble where I tell a little bit of, you know, how this book happened. And I beg the reader to try to hear each voice in its own accent and picture each person in their own shape and color, because this is the great quilt of America. Then the book opens with me as a Hasidic woman, sitting in the backyard with my kids and with our housekeeper, who was from El Salvador. And I knew nothing about El Salvador because I didn't want to know, because I wanted to stay in our bubble. And she says, she's looking at birds in the tree and says, in my country, there are no birds. which was true for a very long time in El Salvador. I said, "What? How come you don't have birds?" This is all in Spanish because she was teaching me Spanish, and my Spanish was bad. And she said, "Because of the guns, and because people eat them for food." But I didn't ask her anything further because I didn't want to know about guns and war and no more food. I wanted my children to feel that they would have paradise. That's how the book opens. And then it turns directly to the story of the El Salvadoran woman. And along the way, I do provide and expose the American involvement, the history, the context. It wasn't a random gang. Her city was overtaken with gangs. Gang problem is huge and a very big problem. In El Salvador, it's sort of a replaying of war and trauma, of inherited trauma in their families, which is so recent. And it goes from story to story like that. I do not group people by where they come from, like every compendium I found. I group them by what caused them to come. And I was shocked to discover that about the first 20 people I met were here because of war. And it was all wars that the U.S. had in some way been involved in. So the whole first section is called We Came in the Aftermath of War. And so each person is from a different part of the world. In between, and in every case, they tell their own stories, which I think is infinitely more impactful. In between each section, there's a section I call an intermezzo, where I interviewed, maybe well over 100 more people than are featured in the book. So in the intermezzo section, it's anywhere between 2 to 4 pages of quotes, just single quotes, sometimes a whole paragraph, usually just a line or two. And each one is someone from another part of the world. And sometimes they're funny, and sometimes they're quaint, and sometimes they're shocking, and sometimes they're just very, very moving. You know, everyone is one of those you can't make this shit up moment. But I wanted to give you a sense of what it's like to walk down the street in Houston, if you could actually hear their stories.
Oh.
Because everywhere else. And then it goes back to another big story.
Yeah.
How did you decide which of the people you interviewed that you were going to share the whole story?
I kind of let my heart decide. The people that whose stories went beyond anything I'd ever heard before. I'm not talking about being unusual. That's the sad part. But in the way they told it, in what happened to them specifically, I let my fiction sense kick in. Is this a story that will take that leap we writers want from the particular to the universal? And does. They're not all tragic. They can be happy. They can be hopeful. There's an Indian couple that I just love their story. And it's about how they had an arranged marriage and they were very well off in India. And then he got a job here, a postdoc, actually. And they came as strangers to one another. There's this interchange where, like, while he goes, she said her mother always did the cooking. He goes, she didn't know how to cook. She goes, he didn't know how to drive. You know, it's like a friend called them up. They actually landed in the northern part of the country. And a friend called them up and said, the first thing you have to do is go to Sears and buy coats. They didn't own coats. Sears.
So yeah.
It's a little while back.
Yeah.
And their arranged marriage became a love story because they needed each other. And they're very, very different from one another. I don't know how happy they would have been in India. I don't know if they grew up and became their own people, what would have played out. They needed each other. And they found that they were there for each other. And you see their story become a love story. It's an American love story. So, you know, there's all kinds of stories in the book.
Leah, would you like to read a little bit from the book for us?
I wanted her to tell us a story about the oil.
Nigeria oil story, because that was just horrendous.
I'll be happy to do that, because that was like one of the defining moments of my life. Mm-hmm. When you read this book, there's always music sort of there, and the opera is unfolding in the background.
Now, you weren't writing the music for this. You were writing the words for the opera.
Right. For every choral work or opera, the words come first.
Okay.
But, you know, to write it, I had to have a sense of music. Totally. The tone, the rhythm, the complexity, or even the pace. It's all in the words that I give them to sing. And the composer knows that. And if a good composer translates that into their music, even when it's, a solo or several people singing together or the chorus, I write all that in.
That you talked about, like, one of the Jewish immigrants, that you didn't want the traditional Jewish music for that. And you told the composer that, and he's like, well, what are you hearing? So you provided a lot of guidance on that.
And I was hearing Shostakovich, a big dissonant sound. Something. And I thought of Russian army boots. I said, think of boots on the piano keys. And he was like, got it. As it's and I would take those quotes that are in the intermezzo, those shorter quotes, and turn them into arias. And I would build from them. It wasn't all their words. Because I always heard all the voices as music, all their different accents, which I loved. I love the fractured English. You know, this is English that people were learning from street signs and television and, you know, people at work. They didn't have time to go take English classes and read books. They had to survive. And it was very, very, I didn't consider it fractured grammar. I considered it creative language. I didn't want to edit that out of the book, and I did so that you could read it more smoothly, but I was sad about it. So there's always music in the background. And as the piece developed, once the composer wrote it, we took sections of the opera to different community centers around Houston. Now, Houston's like more than 100 miles wide, okay? It's enormous. And it's not the most populous, but I think it's got the biggest or second biggest footprint in the U.S. So, you know, some of them were really outlying, but we took the Vietnamese story to a Vietnamese community center, and there were about 100 people there, most of them invited, when they were set to sing it. Well, I'd met this old soldier who had been a soldier for South Vietnam, who we tried to defend, and South Vietnam doesn't exist anymore. And the anthem for South Vietnam that the South Vietnamese army used sounded like an old European marching song sung in Vietnamese. And today it's forbidden to sing. You used to get jail for it. And I'm talking about long term, probably just a fine today, but it just got squashed out of Vietnamese culture. I opened the Vietnamese movement with that anthem, but sung at half tempo. So it sounded not like a marching song, but like an elegy. And when our group performed it at this center, the baritone had studied the Vietnamese. He's just wonderful. His name is Ryan McKinney, and he's quite an opera star today. He was young then. Younger, he sang it with such a pathos. So he starts singing, you know, to open the movement. And I'm sitting on the back row. Nobody knows who I am, just the way I want it. And all of a sudden, one of the men in the audience stood up and slowly put his hand over his heart. And then people pop up, other men of the same age range, pop up around the room. And I realize other people are sitting on the edge of their seats, and they've got their eyes closed, and they're mouthing the words to the song, because they're free to sing that song here. But what a sad freedom that is. I realized that here were people, and they brought their kids and grandkids, people who are here because of a war that we generated, and we failed them. And then they ran right into American arms. How complicated their sense of home had to be. Their sense of this country.
Wow.
So that's my preamble for what I'm going to read.
Okay.
I thought, this is home for all of us now. How complicated their feelings about this country. How compromised their sense of home. What is home? A bedrock, impossible notion I'd held nearly all my life, a place of refuge where I could thrive. It was a trope, really, and reality would always fall short, but the yearning that notion spawned continued in me like a walking dream. To be home, to feel at home, to have a home. Home is where you feel you are of the people around you, where you know you're an intrinsic part of a society you feel you can trust never to turn on you. Home is to be among people you understand because you speak their spoken and emotional and physical language. You know their song. Home means that we own collectively the very dirt beneath our feet. That's the American dream, that impossible, elusive promise to every one of us in this country that anyone can attain their idealized home in America, land of freedom and refuge. I shared their hope that day. Then I teetered to the other side of the hyphen in my hyphenated identity, from child of Jewish refugees to faux white American, and I felt complicit in the promise of freedom we extend. More rose to their feet. The waves rose around us. Around me, heads flung back into memories long locked away. I was wrong, I thought. Ben did not grow up on the other side of some funhouse mirror, which is how I pictured him growing up during the Vietnam War. As I was growing at the same time that I did, as I was growing up, we could not so much as glimpse the life Ben or anyone in that country lived beneath the onslaught, even if a few burning, horrifying photographs that will not die gave us glimmers. This then was our Venn diagram of grief, a room full of Americans of vastly different experiences and backgrounds who sat and stood together that day within a song that for the moment encompassed us all, wrapped us, and held us. We may never find our way out of this music. Old eyes grew wet, and this is a quote from the anthem. Of one heart we go forth with no regret. O citizen, defend your land. I closed it in memory of my stepfather, Brian Dubin, a U.S. Air Force officer in Vietnam who died election eve, November 4th, 2008, from long-term effects of Agent Orange. He refused a military burial. That's the piece I wanted to read.
And that was Leah Lax reading from Not From Here, The Song of America. Now, at the end of the book, you actually have the, is it called libretto? From the opera.
Yeah.
And if somebody wanted to listen to the opera, is there a way for them to find that?
Well, I hope it'll be reprised, but for now, go to www.therefugemusic.com and you can listen to excerpts, and there's some of our favorite parts of it. It was professionally recorded and released by, I think, RCA, if I'm not mistaken, and Naxos. Anyway, it was available on Amazon and on probably today on Spotify. I don't know if it still is. You'd have to look.
Okay.
The Refuge.
The Refuge.
That's to listen to pieces of it.
Wow. So Caroline was asking you to share about the Nigerian oil refugees.
I'd be happy to, but before I do that, Caroline, would you, so it's not all my voice because I get sick of my voice, would you tell me what sparked you to ask the question, where you were going with it, or what it did for you?
That Nigeria. Well, I have a friend of mine is an immigrant from Nigeria, and he didn't ever tell me about this, but I'm going to ask him about it. But that it was just horrible what it did to the land, and the fact that the American company just allowed that and encouraged that, and I just it just made me, it truly made me sick to think about that. It polluted the water and the land, and it just, you know, was really, and I'm anxious to ask Beatrice about it. He's a friend of mine from church, and he and his wife is an authoress, and I have a couple of her books, and I'm going to see if we can't get her to be on the program sometime too, because they're very interesting people.
There's an area, a state in Nigeria called River State in English, so named because it's so well watered, many rivers and lakes. The people that live traditionally on the land call themselves the Ogoni people, and have lived there. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows how long, but you know that a very, very long time, easily over 1,000 years. They're a very interesting group. They're so far inland that the area was not nearly as devastated with kidnappings and. During the era when that was happening and taking people into enslavement. And it also interests me, too, because the Ogoni people made villages all over River State and developed their own languages. So they don't all speak the same language. And they don't all live in the same place. You know, they live in the same rough area, but they consider themselves one people. I think that's powerful. The person who was telling me the story was old enough that he remembered when shale oil first came in. He remembered before shale oil came in. He remembered the good life they had because food was abundant. They fished and they farmed. Fish was a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
He was a happy kid. And then it was Royal Dutch Shell that came in. Discovered some of the world's biggest oil reserves beneath Ogoni land. And in part because of the, I think, because of the view that the lives of the people affected because they were black and African didn't matter. But they laid pipelines around Ogoni land above ground. And so they were like 6 feet tall. And they ran some of them right through villages, even across family thresholds. It was insane. And they dug wherever they dug, which could be a family field, and disrupt or devastate a family's ability to raise food for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So people began to protest. As soon as there was any hint of protest, because the government had quite a lucrative contract with Shell, they sent the military in. And
right.
And they didn't hold back. Ultimately, I'm not going to give you all the details. This happened in stages. They killed tens of thousands of people. A group arose that wanted that advocated peaceful protest and appealed to the government for a share in the profit of the land that they own. This is a problem in many places, including in this country. If it were traditional people, they had owned it so long, they didn't have paperwork to prove it. They didn't have contracts. And so the courts could say, no, you don't. But they asked for a share in the profits, and they drew up what they called an Ogoni Bill of Rights. That was a reason for the military then to occupy the area. Meanwhile, it didn't take long till the pipes started to leak, and the ground became saturated with oil. There were gas leaks that caught fire, so there was fire shooting air, and a continual boom, boom every time it hit a pocket. It was a completely hellish environment. The family that I met was the young man who grew up. He became the spiritual leader of the Ogoni movement. And the kids who were young adults when I met them were born and raised in that terrible environment and ultimately ran for their lives. They are eco-refugees. And they are here because of oil. I have to point out that the U.S. is the largest buyer of Nigerian oil in the world.
And they
were brought because they were identified and brought here as refugees and given a beautiful home. Like, it's that same irony.
Yeah. So go on. Well, you weren't able to share this story completely in the opera.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah, tell us what happened there.
I found this family so full of faith and so positive and with such an amazing sense of humor. I ran into that everywhere. My book is not dark. It's hopeful. It's like, this is our reality. And these are people who make a life and love being here. They don't think America's bad. They think America's not as bad as the rest of the world. And so they love it. We think it's all bad. It's a different viewpoint. It's not a dark thing. But I did come in to the to that interview, still my idealistic new writer, new in the world self. And when we sat down, the father of the family, Bishop, said, tell me, can you really write anything we say here today? I said, of course I can. It's a miracle. It's me. And so you forget about it, that, you know, that happens right at the beginning, because they proceed into a story that just like you are holding your breath the entire time. And interspersed in some of the darkest moments is just moments of total hilarity. I mean, because that was part of their faith, you know, this vision that I had run away from a religious environment, right? And I'd rejected all of that. So there was so much cognitive dissonance going on. I cannot, so many drop in your jaw moments for this clueless, ridiculously clueless American, clueless person. I can't tell you. But I love the story, and I wrote it into the libretto. I turned it in to Houston Grand Opera. It was finalized. They made the press announcement, everything. And then they shared the libretto with the board. So the arts are so big and so beautiful and so well developed because corporations, for the sake of their bottom line, give away some of their money, you know, in charitable giving. And they support the arts in Houston. You get on the website of any of the big arts organizations, and the first 15 or 20 names are going to be oil-related businesses that are headquartered or located in Houston. And they share it with the board. I get a call late in the game. I go to be this time ready to defend what I wrote and feeling much older and much more sure of myself. I sat down with the director, Anthony Freud, who we haven't seen at this point since the beginning of the book. And he very sadly, with great hesitation, clearly his hands were tied, says, in this opera, you cannot say Ogoni. You cannot say Shell. You cannot even say the word oil.
Oh. Yeah.
Nobody had to censor me. I mean, what I'm trying to say is nobody was censoring the opera. They were censoring themselves for the sake of corporate money. That's what's happening in our media. That's what's happening everywhere. I was looking at the evolution into corporate America. And I didn't know it then. I didn't know that's what was happening. I was still so ridiculously innocent. Not anymore. I had to go back to that family. I mean, there's stories of Nigerian prisons and 9-year-olds seeing their friends shot in the chest, and you know, their resilience, their love of one another, their love of America despite everything. I mean, at that point I was speechless in front of them. I felt like a nothing in front of these truly great people. And I had to say, in this opera, I can't say Ogoni, I can't say Shell, I can't say oil. And the father said, thank you very much, we will not be attending your opera.
So,
well,
Leah,
unfortunately, you can say it on our program.
Yeah, really.
I had to ask myself, why did they tell their story? You know, I go out of the car and have a big cry, right? And then I said, well, they know from the beginning. They always knew. Why did they spend all those hours with me? And then I had the ultimate conclusion as a writer. It's because in America they still can. Mm. They said it if they can. And I will too.
Oh, so Leah, this opera was came out in 2008, I think, 2007, 2008, and the book Not From Here is being published in 2024. Why did you wait so long to write this book?
I was speechless for a long time, and I had such a strong sense of obligation that I couldn't edit anybody out, but altogether. I had over 1,000 pages of transcript, even edited down. It was nearly 500 pages. I wasn't sure. I had to grow as a writer. Wasn't sure what to do. And then 2016, we had an election and and immigration became a hotly contested issue. And I knew enough to know the just enormous amount of lies that were being bandied about to scare people and mislead people for the sake of getting power. And I knew I had to do something. It took a long time to write. Every good book does. But also, I'm an older woman. I'm a lesbian. That's a very difficult position to get published in. Because publishers are corporate these days. It's not only about art. It's about who they think your market's going to be. And I got an agent, but many, many rejections that said, I love this book. I'm sorry. I don't have to put it on our bookshelf, or I don't feel that I can sell it to my board or that, da, 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 da. You know, artistically, that took a couple of years.
Well, I'm glad it's out now. There's so many moving stories, so many, you know, maybe if people can just see these immigrants as human beings with stories, maybe they'll be more open to justice.
Oh, I want them to see immigrants as us, as you and me, every single person. If not, then we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be Americans. That's who we are. It's just a momentary glimpse. It's not a snapshot of a process that stretches to the beginning and will not stop. That's all. It's how we build. It's how we stay alive. It's how we grow.
Well, thank you, Leah, for being with us today. And Caroline, do you have some final words for us?
Yes, I do. This is a story I have. This friend of mine who immigrated from Nigeria. A group of us went with him to a federal building to obtain his citizenship status. And there were people there from all over the world. And when the judge walked in to the building, he looked around and he said, today, everybody wins. I thought that was fantastic.
What a feel-good moment.
Yeah.
What a great moment.
All right. Well, thank you. And thank you for being with us, Leah Lax, author of Not From Here, The Song of America. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
I enjoyed this, and thank you so much.